The search and rescue mission in Surfside has transitioned to recovery. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Last night, Miami-Dade County officials broke the difficult news to family members and survivors. Workers are now pouring through the rubble, hoping to uncover bodies. Plus, housing for those impacted by other building evacuations remains a significant question. We'll hear from the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust about potential options. And with millions of dollars raised to support Surfside, how and when will that money be spent? But first, an update on Haiti's political crisis following the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. A group of gunmen assassinated Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, and wounded his wife in their home yesterday morning. His wife, Martine Moïse, was airlifted to Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, and she is in critical condition there. The country's police chief has announced that seven suspects have been killed during a shootout with police. Six others have been arrested in connection to the assassination. Joining us now is WLRN reporter Wilkin Brutus and University of Miami professor Louis Hearns Marceline. He's also the chancellor for INURED, a research institution in Haiti. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Wilkin, you have close family ties to Haiti. What are you hearing from your friends and family during this uncertain time?
Hey, Katie. Fatigue. The morale is as low as it 2010. When the earthquake shattered Haiti. I spoke to my mom right after the assassination, and it's difficult to describe the sadness and uncertainty in her voice. She basically sounded defeated because for her, the desire to see her country improve extends beyond her own political beliefs. There is just a strong desire to do simple things like travel back and forth, visit family, develop businesses, because sending remittances is never enough. And there is a lack of trust and confusion now because she doesn't know who to make more accountable after the assassination, foreign or domestic involvement. Either way, she, you know, like many family members, just needs a normal functioning society in Haiti.
And Louis, what are you hearing from your connections in Haiti?
Well, as you know, I run an institute, an interdiversity institute in Haiti. And I have my staff is mostly in Port-au-Prince and about 20 staff, and some of them also in the provinces, in the regions of Haiti. And what we realize is that, you know, people, as your previous colleague said, are in a state of shock. And the predominant word here is anxiety. People don't know what is to come. People don't know what to make, you know, of this political conjuncture. And they are well. Everybody is locked up in their own houses. And unless they have something important to do out there, people don't go out because of the situation.
It's a difficult time. Wilkin, you spoke yesterday with Palm Beach County Commissioner Mac Bernard. He was born in Haiti and moved to South Florida as a child. Let's hear from him.
The overriding message that I'm getting from them is that they're calling on the Haitian people to remain calm and to remain peaceful through these dark days.
And so it took us a second to hear from him, but he's been talking in that bite about the messages that he's getting from Haitian constituents. Before the assassination, Haiti was already going through a violent crime crisis. Wilkin, how might this impact that situation?
Yeah, the commissioner said Haitians are always resilient, but there is a breaking point. His constituents echoed what many Haitians are saying in several spaces, that there are concerns about three main things. The transition in power. It looks like a lot of people don't know who will take on the presidency because of the instability of the government. Prime Minister Claude Joseph might be the one to make that decision. The second one is the international community's response, or how the foreign policy apparatus will react moving forward. And the third what Haitians in the what can Haitians in the diaspora can do to help the fractured political parties that are on the ground in Haiti. These are like the three main things, despite the sort of resiliency that he echoes in that bite.
Well, Louis, you know, Wilkin just mentioned this, but beyond the violent crime crisis we're seeing at the moment, the country was dealing with this constitutional crisis and an economic collapse before. Can you sort of lay out the situation in the country leading up to the president's assassination?
Yes, and I think that one thing that we should not forget is that the complexity of so many actors that are involved in Haiti. We will remember that less than 20 years ago, and a minister, United Nations, you know, was involved in Haiti for about 15 years. And the fundamental mission of minister was to help rebuild security institutions and the judiciary system and the rule of law institutions. Minister left Haiti after, you know, billions of dollars spent in Haiti. The security institutions in Haiti weren't better, and the justice system, you know, has crumbled, and all the rule of law principle, all the arbitrage of the rule of law that we would have in a society, which was the very fundamental mission of minister to help Haiti in its difficult moment after, mostly after the earthquake, and they weren't done. And after that, you have a remnants of United Nations that still remain in Haiti, working exactly in these areas. And what we have seen was a complete progressive degradation of these institutions. What is important also to make note of is the fact that the event of yesterday was a culmination of a process. We have seen during the latter 3 months a complete degradation of the, you know, security situation in Haiti. Because in Haiti, we have a kind of conflation of gangs and politics going together. People use gangs as proxy, either not just to settle political scores, but also to get engaged in market control, in territory control, and so forth, et cetera. So the rise of criminality has totally disable the possibility for politics to happen in the country. In the midst of all of this, you see the foreign nations who are friends of Haiti, like the United States, insisting every single minute, instead of addressing the security issue of the country, instead of creating, helping Haiti, reinforcing its institution of rule of law, that President Jovenel Moïse himself has been dismantling. And it was under their eyes all of these things were happening. And today you see everybody is outraged about what had happened in Haiti, but it was under their eyes when President Jovenel Moïse was dismantling these institutions. It was under their eyes when everybody was crying, saying that, you know, with the total insecurity that filled the country, with the fragmentation of the city into territories controlled by different gangs, and with all the death and kidnappings that are happening, there is a need to address the security situation first before you think about, you know, what are the legitimacy of those who are going to implement the elections. So the question here I think the event of yesterday is not just the event itself, but Haiti today asks for a rethinking of the way that the international community engage with Haiti. In general, when they engage with Haiti, they take the place of Haiti. The arrogance of their presence, you know, disable the possibilities of Haitian institutions to learn and then to build up in order for them to take care of themselves. So that's the same thing that happened with the minister, with United Nations in Haiti. What we have as a legacy is the legacy of despair, cholera, and sexual abuse and all the like.
Well, I just want to take a second and reintroduce you to our audience. I am speaking with University of Miami professor Louis Hearns Marceline and WLRN reporter Wilkin Brutus. Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated at his home in Port-au-Prince yesterday morning. His wife was wounded in the attack. She's now receiving medical treatment in Miami. We're talking about the impact that this attack is having on Haiti and the diaspora. You can find more of the latest on the story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Wilkin, unfortunately, when news like this breaks, it opens the door up for misinformation. How are these stories spreading and what's being done to correct those falsehoods?
Yeah, Lewis makes some great points about the consolidation of power and the support from the foreign policy apparatus. But to your question about the misinformation and disinformation online, the Clinton Foundation was trending on Twitter, for example, in which people were insinuating that Moise was assassinated because of it. That one-dimensional, unfounded opinion of the current situation obscures the many political realities on the ground in Haiti. This assassination is, to Lewis's point, a culmination of months of political uncertainty and violence, of power consolidation, and journalists are still trying to figure out what happened. There are some inconvenient truths that need to be contextualized, some historical context, to better understand why Haiti is in its current state and the fear young Haitians have over the foreign policy apparatus, because unfortunately foreign intervention has had a checkered and violent past. So to fix any falsehoods, transparency more than ever is extremely important, but that means really amplifying Haitian subject matter experts.
And Louis, another worry now is the transition of power in Haiti. Where does the country go from here?
Where does the country go from here? Of course, we are in the midst of confusion because we have total collapse of most of the institutions in Haiti. Now, what is needed now is a rapid, you know, mechanisms to stabilize the country, because realistically, that's what has to be done. And to stabilize the country, we have to be able, there is a need to have a conduit that can facilitate a dialogue between the sectors in Haiti, the political sectors, but particularly the main actors. And when I am talking about the actors, I'm not just talking about the traditional actors that the international communities and countries like the United States rely on. For example, you know, the big business owners, the big political party, the big individual leaders. I'm talking also about grassroots organizations, community-based organizations, churches, different sectors in society. They need that engagement in order for them to agree on a mechanism for a government or a transitional government that can ensure a process that leads to elections and that could lead to a process for us to develop a roadmap to know how we are going to get out of our hole. And for this, Haitians have to be at the core, as your guest mentioned. Haitians have to be at the core. We cannot have experts from outside coming to Haiti, you know, with their own political projects, imposing it on Haiti. And after that, they go, and then the situation remains the same as it was before.
We heard from Chantal Verna, and I want to bring her into this conversation for a moment on that exact point. She's an associate professor at Florida International University. Her research and writing has focused on U.S.-Haiti relations. And I just want to share some tape we have from her on her thoughts on the U.S. intervention in Haiti right now.
I personally, and many others, find that to be highly problematic in the sense that it is presented independent of the reality that foreign intervention has been violent, it has been racist, it has been imperialistic, it has been many negative things, even when it comes with so-called good intentions. And so that is why we've seen the many interventions in the past decades of the late 20th and early 21st century. It's been part of why we haven't seen the results that have been promised, right? Those promises that I've written about.
And I want to ask each of you, and for time here, just briefly, if you could each mention, what do you foresee on this front now that there have been talks about the Haitian diaspora here in the U.S. and putting this pressure on the Biden administration to respond? Wilkin?
No.
Yeah, sure. There is a power vacuum in Haiti and an information gap among many within the Haitian diaspora. So young Haitians on several online platforms and Haitian constituents locally are saying once the Biden administration gets involved, which presumably they will, it has to openly and very publicly include a Haitian diaspora to help build a transitional team with faces attached to it that could then produce adequate infrastructure, a functioning political institution, and a true transparent democratic process. especially after the controversial U.S. involvement with the 2010 Haitian election. Our very own WLRN Latin America reporter, Tim Pageant, spoke to Dr. Gerda Nicolas, a Haitian American psychology professor at UM, University of Miami, and she expressed a similar sentiment. You can't move forward without the Haitian diaspora. You just can't.
And Louis, you mentioned something similar. How do you feel about this moving forward? What do you foresee?
Yes, I think that just to add to what the colleague just mentioned here, yes, the diaspora is critical in order to help, you know, to help the country address these challenges. However, what I wanted just to rapidly say something here about, you know, the international community engagement when I talk about that in the case of Haiti for the future. The whole point is to all engagement, all forms of engagement that we used to have were engagements that substitute the responsibility of the state of Haiti and the responsibility of Haitians and to delegate it to somebody else. And therefore, instead of the state, instead of the actors taking their responsibility to deliver to the country in terms of security, health, education, and so forth and so on, they delegate, they remain, they accaparate of whatever remains of the resources of the country and expect that the international community will fulfill or the diaspora will fill the gap. We need to have a clear structure roadmap that allows us to know how we are going to have these different layers of engagement.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I've been speaking with University of Miami professor Louis Hearns Marceline. He's also the chancellor for INURED, a research institution in Haiti, as well as WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus. Wilkin and Louis, thank you so much for being with us.
Merci, Katie. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Still to come, Search and Rescue turns to search and recovery. We get an update on the latest from Surfside. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. The search and rescue efforts at the site of the Surfside condo collapse have officially switched to recovery operations. The death toll now stands at 60. 80 people are still unaccounted for as of mid-morning. WLRN's health reporter Veronica Zaragovia joins us now from the site, and she's been following what's been happening there closely. Veronica, how has the transition from search and rescue over to recovery changed things at the site?
Well, Katie, what officials say is that it changes little in terms of the speed and the dedication to the site and to the work. They will continue to be there around the clock, but it will change, for instance, the dogs that are used to search for signs of life would no longer be used and instead would be dogs who can detect humans who have died. And so those are maybe some of the changes that and also what they're looking for all of this time. They've been searching for voids where it would have been possible for a person to be found possibly alive. And they've concluded they just can't find anymore. They can't find them. And so it's just the nature of the collapse. So they had to make this really very difficult decision.
When you were covering the press conference with Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava last night, what was the impetus behind changing over to recovery, and how did families respond to that?
From what she has shared and the officials who have spoken with families, such as Miami-Dade Fire Assistant Chief Ray Jadala, that it was just extremely hard for them to share this news with families. However, families get lengthy briefings at least twice a day. And so it seems that families were preparing for this moment. That happened at midnight. But, you know, last night, this morning is when that officially changed to a recovery effort. And basically, you know, there's little that we know exactly about how it looks differently because it's still they need to get the debris that's heading to be examined for the purposes of the investigation that's underway. So it's just more like the understanding that there are no victims who have survived alive is what the understanding is from this official change.
Well, it's good to hear that because the families were receiving briefings, that it did not come as a surprise to them.
Right.
I'm curious, what are you hearing from people about how things are different on the ground today?
You know, it's just been really, since that press conference concluded the evening one yesterday, the mood was just very heavy, because even though everybody who's been following this also expected that we were coming to this point, because Miami-Dade Fire Chief Ellen Kaminsky had mentioned earlier in the day that they hadn't found a victim who had survived at any point after the collapse. So it just seemed like people had died pretty much right away, and it just seemed like there weren't any signs of life and for a long time. And so everybody's just really struggling. And there was a 15-minute moment of silence after that, with all of the search and rescue team members and officials and clergy. And you could see the enormity, family members. You could just see how big this operation has been and how many people it's affected. And also there was afterwards everybody gathered by the makeshift memorial, which is along a tennis court fence across from what used to be the Champlain Tower South. And there was a candlelight prayer in Spanish. Nuns were giving out rosaries, and people were repeating prayers for the people who have died. And it just seems like a very inclusive moment, regardless of religion or language, everybody was there.
That sounds beautiful. We spoke with a member of the Israeli search and rescue team that's helping yesterday about how important their work continues to be in this recovery process. So they're still doing important work. That has not changed.
That's right. That's right. I think everybody, you know, there's the people who work, the responders, everybody involved are not even able to go home. They're sleeping near the site after their 12-hour shifts. And there have been buses that have been provided for them to cool down. And Royal Caribbean has provided a ship to help some of the people who are coming from other states to have a place to rest. And so nothing visually is changing in terms of nobody's leaving this site. And the work continues. And we, of course, at WLRN will be very carefully continuing to cover the many angles of this disaster.
And I want to shift a little bit, because you've been following a situation nearby. Since the Surfside collapse, we've seen inspections of other condo buildings increase. And you've been following what's been happening after the evacuation of a 10-story condo in North Miami Beach last Friday night. The Crestview Towers were evacuated after an inspection found that it was not structurally safe to be occupied. There was an update this morning at 11. What is the latest on that situation close to you?
Right. And I've been following, because all of this is connected to the disaster in Surfside has prompted a lot of spotlights on what's going on in these buildings. And so what we learned today at the Crestview Towers is that people will be allowed to go tomorrow, Friday, between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. for 15 minutes. And only one family member per unit will be allowed in to get things like valuable, maybe jewelry or paperwork or medicine, but no furniture. And they've also launched, North Miami Beach Chief Richard Rand announced that they've launched an investigation after residents had sent emails about possible misappropriation of funds by the condo association and ones in the past. And so we're learning that he's been in touch with the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office, and they're taking very seriously the concerns of residents who've been living in Crestview apartments.
Have you heard anything from residents of that building?
Yes, so there was a group of residents who came out very concerned to try to hear what we reporters were finding out at that moment. And for instance, Maria Rodriguez told me she has two young infants, and she was not able to grab all of their things when they had to leave the building. And so she is very worried that in those 15 minutes tomorrow, she won't be able to grab things that they need. And they're staying in a hotel, which is very costly, and she doesn't know how much longer they can live in a hotel. I spoke to another resident who has two young children as well, and he was saying it's just this horrible feeling of not being able to answer questions that his children or his wife ask they just had to get out, and they're also living in a place where they pay by the day. And the concerns that we'll listen soon with other guests on the program, but are the fact that they've already paid rent and now they're paying for these short-term accommodations. And people, this is not a high-income build. Residents are not necessarily high-income, and this is just very difficult. Yes, yes.
Well, I've been speaking with WLRN reporter Veronica Zaragovia about the latest on the recovery efforts in Surfside. You've been wearing a lot of hats. Thank you for all you're doing on the ground to keep people informed.
Thank you so much. It's an honor. Thank you.
And we're going to talk more about this Crestview building in North Miami Beach. It's 10 stories high, and it was evacuated immediately last Friday night. Tomorrow marks 1 week since 156 condo units were displaced. They're suddenly faced with, just like Veronica mentioned, having to find housing for them and their families. The Miami-Dade Homeless Trust is housing 55 individuals, 6 dogs, and 3 cats. Ron Book, the chairman of the Homeless Trust, joins us now to answer some housing questions, along with Rob Weil, reporter for the Miami Herald. Rob, we'll bring you in first. With your reporting, what questions remain unanswered to you after this 11 a.m. update?
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend the update, but certainly a lot of questions about what exactly this condo association was up to. We do know that this morning a representative for the city sent out an email. The association had racked up about $600,000 in fines since 2014 alone. So we know from my reporting and others that they missed their 40-year required 40-year inspection, which is itself, you know, a major issue
and required by law.
Right, exactly. And they appear to have been content to kind of just skip and just keep paying these fines rather than have to deal with all the damage that it appears they have been facing over the years.
And Rob, I want to stick with you for a moment because I understand the Condo Association for Crestview submitted its report about structural and electrical conditions, but the city of North Miami Beach had to reject the report because it just didn't contain the proper paperwork, the proper documentation. Now the Condo Association is trying to rework and provide the required information so that the city can take a look. But do we have any idea how long that's expected to take, that process?
We appear to be at the very beginning because the city is demanding not only to resubmit the condo's own inspection report, but to pull permits to prove that they are taking this seriously and pull permits to begin the necessary repairs. And that also hasn't happened yet. So there's still a lot of work to be done on this, unfortunately.
And Ron, I want to bring you in. After the people living in Crestview Towers were evacuated late last week, how did the Homeless Trust get called in to help, and where did those residents get sent for housing?
Well, thank you very much. Actually, we got a call about 4:30 on Friday asking for help. We got a brief explanation as to what occurred. We went over immediately. I think I was on the site by 5:15 or 5:30. The rest of my staff arrived about the same time. We quickly began to assess the situation, make calls, making certain that we had some authorization from the county mayor to send folks to a specific location, Red Cross to make sure we could get cots, blankets, pillows, food, snacks, things like that that we would need to manage the site, and then began almost simultaneous with assembling our team, which consists of individuals who do assessments of those families, income assessment, family assessment, what are their needs, what are their obligations, do they qualify for particular kinds of rental assistance and subsidies and the like. Secondly, we then immediately began to move to find properties where we could move folks out of where we put them Friday night, which was really just, let's get everybody to one place, let's make sure they're safe, make sure they're not sleeping on the streets, not in their cars, there were lots of little kids. When we got the call Friday, we were told there might be 40 kids, there might be 50 kids, there might be 60 kids.
Well, and what do you mean by properties? Do you mean hotels?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, look, you can't keep people in a shelter environment that have never lived communally before. We're not talking about people that have ever been homeless before. You have people with babies as young as 4 months old, lots of one-year-old, two-year-old, three-year-olds, and a lot of six, seven, and eight-year-olds. And in fact, today, I literally just got back in front of the computer, having been back down in North Miami Beach, where the manager was bringing the media up to speed. I found eight more families that had been living in cars, everyone but two with little children. And the two that didn't were taking care of elderly, infirm family members. And so we quickly moved to get them to a place of safety and security and the like. Our folks then use our housing coordinators to work with those families, those that get some level of temporary rental assistance, and those that don't, but working to work within the confines of their budgets to find them places for permanent housing. Let's just be clear. We have no reason, the trust has no reason to believe, based on the communications daily, many times during the day, since Friday, that anybody is going to be back living in that building in the reasonably short future. Tomorrow, the city is going to allow people in for very short 10-minute blocks. It's an orderly planned program so people can go back in, get their medicines, gather up any other significant documents, materials, and or mementos that they may need in the short term until such time as they can hopefully get back in and either resettle back in or move permanently to a new location.
Well, let me ask you, Ron, does this situation affect the Homeless Trust's regular efforts and regular day-to-day work to house people who are experiencing homelessness?
Look, anytime we divert off of dealing with our day-to-day responsibilities, it takes something away. It takes something away in human resources. It takes something away in monetary resources. But let's be clear. The Homeless Trust engages in rapid rehousing on a regular basis. We catch people, you know, with that safety net before they become homeless. We've been doing since November an aggressive effort to identify where people are that may be the subject of those 7,000 pending eviction actions already pending in the courts. So that we are working to get them either rental assistance or opportunities to avoid being homeless even one day. So these are things we know how to do. I can tell you the county mayor by Saturday had spoken not only to me directly a dozen times, as well as her chief of staff, Joanna Savone, but with Frank Rollison, the emergency management director, she has directed Frank to begin to work with the Trust, Red Cross, and other related stakeholders in the community to come up with a plan so that if we face this again, and we will, it's not if, it's when, then we're in a better place from a planning standpoint to know where we're going to take people.
And I'm going to ask you about that in just a moment, but I do want to reintroduce you to our audience. I'm speaking with Ron Book, the chairman of the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust, and Rob Weil, reporter for the Miami Herald. We're talking about people getting displaced from apartment buildings now that more inspections are underway in the wake of the Surfside tragedy. Rob, I want to sort of reorient us for a minute, because people who lived in the Champlain Towers in Surfside that have been displaced, do they get FEMA money and assistance with their housing? Are they getting help from the county, or are they also being supported by the Homeless Trust? And I just sort of wanted to see, what's the situation? Who all are we talking about suddenly becoming homeless?
Yeah, FEMA is involved in Surfside. I don't, to my knowledge, and Ron may have better knowledge on Crestview. I don't think FEMA is involved in Crestview, correct, Ron?
They are not involved at the present time.
Okay.
And nor would they qualify for Stafford Act declarations at this juncture. This is a condemned building. FEMA doesn't generally, and the feds don't generally declare states of emergency in circumstances like this. We're in a unique situation in this community.
Yeah, and I would emphasize too, and I think Ron could speak to this directly, which is that the resources, there is a yawning gulf between the kinds of resources that, you know, the people who are living in, who have been affected in Surfside have at their disposal. And that's not to minimize what they're going through. But in North Miami Beach, we are dealing with a whole different type of people, heavily working class, heavily immigrant, don't have a lot of fallback options. So the strain, the local strain is tremendous at this moment.
I would echo that, Rob. You've seen it. Look, more than half, to put it in perspective, more than half, and I cannot give you a firm number, but I can tell you more than 50% are in the poverty zone. They're living at 50% or more, or less, I should say, below the area mean income, the AMI for the community. So you are looking at people with very fixed income. I went to an event this morning, as I alluded to already, eight more families. They were hysterical crying. They've been living in their cars with young children. Of the eight, that was six of them. And the other two had elderly parent or parents living in the cars with them.
Well, and Ron, there's a lot of complicated difficulties with individual needs here. Quickly, for time, I did want to ask you, you alluded to being concerned that other buildings that may get inspected in the wake of Surfside will also lead to other evacuations. Is the Homeless Trust prepared to handle that?
We're ready to jump and do the things we know how to do well. We are waiting on Frank Rollison and the mayor as they're working to develop a longer plan to make sure that futuristically we fit into whatever role they want us in. Right now, we're it. Right now, we're who people can call. And I think that, mayors largely relied on us for the time being to meet these needs. And we're going to do so to the best of our ability. But let's be clear. Our resources are stretched because of COVID. We spent down all of our resources. We are doing what we need to do to make sure we leave no one on the streets.
Well, there's a lot more to dig into here. We'll have to leave it there for time. But I've been speaking with Ron Book, the chairman of the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust, and Rob Weil from the Miami Herald. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Still to come, money is continuing to come in for those impacted by the Surfside tragedy. How are those funds going to be spent? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Millions of dollars have been raised to support victims' family members of the Surfside tragedy and the survivors. The Coral Gables Foundation, the Key Biscayne Foundation, and the Miami Foundation have teamed up to create the Support Surfside Compassion Fund. Well, yesterday, the fund announced their partnership with the National Compassion Fund, a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to supporting people impacted by mass tragedies. Lauren Parra is the public affairs director for the Miami Foundation. She joins us now. And we should just note the CEO and president of the Miami Foundation, Rebecca Fishman Lipsey, was scheduled to join us today, but she is on a call with Governor Ron DeSantis as we speak. Lauren, let's review the numbers. How much has been raised for family members of victims and the survivors of the Surfside collapse over the past 2 weeks?
Hi, Katie. Thanks for having me. Really, if I can, I just really wanted to take a second and start by saying how saddened we are by the recent news that, unfortunately, the Surfside Rescue Mission has now begun to transition to a recovery effort. We've actually met a lot of those families who were anxiously waiting for this news, and really just wanted to take a second to acknowledge them and how deeply saddened we are and how our thoughts are with them. But You know, we have been as a community incredibly lucky to receive generosity from around the world in our moment of crisis. Support Surfside has received over $2 million in donations and another $1.3 million in pledges from over 13,000 unique and individual donors from around the world.
Yeah, do we know where those funds are all coming from?
From really every part of the world. I mean, Miami is such a diverse and unique community. We have representation from over, you know, dozens and dozens of countries. And so it's really been an incredible privilege to watch as the global community and our region has coalesced to provide support in our time of need.
How much has been distributed to individuals already? And is it in the form of direct payments?
Yeah, so we've actually distributed over $155,000 to about 150 individuals that have been directly affected. We've actually been stationed at the Family Assistance Center, which was put up by, of course, all the emergency operations here in Surfside. We've been here since it opened, and so we've been able to interface with victims, their families, individuals directly, and we've been handing out prepaid Visa gift cards, actually. You know, unfortunately, a lot of these folks don't have access to their bank accounts, their bank cards, their driver's licenses. I mean, they've really lost everything. And so for us, being able to create even a semblance, a tiny bit of agency for individuals to have cash in hand and purchase the items that they need in this moment was really the best thing we could do. But additionally, we've actually already distributed $155,000 to 8 nonprofits. We're actually on the ground and providing emergency relief services as well. So to date, we've already distributed over $300,000 from these funds.
And what organizations, these nonprofits you mentioned, what are they working on the ground? And what funding have they received from the Support Surfside effort in terms of the nature of the work that they're doing?
Sure. So it's 8 different nonprofits, and those nonprofits range from Hatzal of South Florida, the Jewish Community Services of South Florida, to the Salvation Army, the American Red Cross. And these are organizations that have been on the ground in Surfside from, you know, unfortunately, the day that this happened. And they are providing services that range from immediate food relief to mental health counseling, just a wide range of relief services that are really necessary for folks who have been impacted by this tragedy.
Are there any restrictions or stipulations about how that money can be spent, whether it's by individuals or by these nonprofits?
Again, in this first initial phase of funding, we've committed $1 million of what we've already raised to get out as immediate relief to these families and these victims. And for us, you know, these are charitable dollars, and so we want to create as much agency for folks as possible. They know best as to how they can fulfill their own needs in this moment of crisis. And so for us, it's been really important to be able to provide those prepaid gift cards. And now we've actually transitioned to providing relief through ACH and checks. And so these individuals affected by this tragedy have full agency on how they use these charitable funds.
And why was the former president of Miami-Dade College, Eduardo Padron, appointed to oversee the distribution of Support Surfside funds?
Sure. Thanks for that question. We are so excited and proud to have Dr. Padron as the chair of this committee. Like you mentioned, we've actually partnered with the National Compassion Fund, and it was their recommendation that we put together a committee of folks, of trusted leaders, of folks who could lead an incredibly transparent process when it comes to distributing these funds here in Miami. And we really could not be more thankful for somebody like Dr. Padron, who has a rich history of public service here in this community and will help lead an incredibly transparent process.
I'm speaking with Lauren Parra, Public Affairs Director for the Miami Foundation. The Miami Foundation, along with the Key Biscayne Foundation and the Coral Gables Community Foundation, have partnered together for the Support Surfside Compassion Fund. You can find more information about ways to support individuals impacted by Surfside on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Lauren, what's the timeline to distribute the rest of the funding to families and organizations? I know you mentioned this was phase one.
Yeah, so phase one includes this $1 million commitment, and we are moving as quickly as possible. And so if any of the listeners need information on how to access that first $1 million immediate relief, I'd ask them to go to supportsurfside.org. There's a big red button, apply now, and you can go through a very quick 5-minute application. We are committed to getting out this $1 million in the coming weeks very quickly, as the need on the ground is quite urgent.
When you alluded to this a little earlier, but when the rest of the Champlain Tower South building was demolished Sunday, any hope of families recovering prized possessions or even just their everyday possessions was lost. Does the building demolition change what types of goods families are in need of now? And are you seeking donations in the form of anything like furniture or clothing, things like that?
Sure. And so at this time, Support Surfside is only taking financial donations. And again, for us, it's just been a really important thing to provide agency to families, right? And so to your point, a lot of these families have now lost every physical possession that they previously owned. And so our ability to allow them to decide exactly what it is that can be most helpful in this time of crisis has been a guiding light for this initiative.
How long will the fundraising process continue for the Support Surfside initiative? Do you have an end date or a target amount in mind of how much you want to raise?
We are actively working with all of our relief partners here in Surfside. And so long as there is need on the ground, we will continue to fundraise for these families and in the hopes of providing some financial relief. We understand that money will by no means bring back what was lost for these families, but we certainly hope that it can make a difference for those in need.
And what's the best way for individuals to support people affected by Surfside and support these fundraising efforts now?
Sure, there's a number of incredible charitable funds that have stood up over the past 2 weeks. Support Surfside is only one of them, but if folks want to make donations to a number of other organizations, the Greater Jewish Federation, the United Way, a lot of incredible nonprofits have come together to raise money and find relief for these families.
When you've spoken with some of the families directly, what has it meant for them to get this level of support from around the globe? Are there any stories you want to share?
I think from my personal perspective being here at the FAC, it's just been remarkable to see the layers of people who have been affected by this tragedy. And so, of course, we think about the individuals who lost loved ones in this tragic event. We think about the people who have now lost all of their worldly possessions because they were demolished in the second in this demolition. But there are people who perhaps worked in the building and now have no form of employment, or the nurses that were caretakers for folks who lived in the building as well. And so it's just been a really beautiful thing to see how in Miami's time of need, really this region has stood up to help see these families and these individuals through. And we're incredibly grateful to be a part of that.
I've been speaking with Lauren Parra, Public Affairs Director for the Miami Foundation. You can find more details about the Support Surfside Fund by heading to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Thank you for joining us, Lauren.
Thank you, Katie.
I just want to note, we spoke earlier on the program about concerns related to other condo buildings. People are encouraged to go to myfloridalicense.com. Again, that's myfloridalicense.com. This is under the Florida Department of Business and Professional Regulation, to let officials know if they suspect any mismanagement or wrongdoing by their condo associations. And that'll do it for Sundial on Thursday, July 8th. Sundial's senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Paolo at gopaolo.com. You can download a podcast of this program. Search WLRN Sundial in your podcast app. Coming up next week on Sundial, what role could climate change and sea level rise play in threatening the safety of condos across South Florida? Our environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich has been exploring this story since the Surfside condo collapse. She'll explain the answer is more complicated than it seems. Plus, we'll continue to follow updates out of Haiti as the country continues to reel from the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. The country's in a state of emergency as the investigation into his death and the replacement of leadership continues. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week. This program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.